This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
This is the recording. So the lecture is called Political Polarization, Pervasive Loneliness, and the Exhausted Middle. And as a way into the discussion, I want to present tell about a psychological experiment, a three-week psychological experiment that happened in the 50s, 1954, that in some ways mirrors. It acts, I think, as a parable for our moment. And it does so because it shows that I think polarization is not primarily or exclusively about disagreeing about issues. Disagreeing about issues is part of it, but there's something else. And this psychological experiment, I think, shows the power of belonging to a tribe, the attractiveness of that, the appeal of having meaning, and being part of a team. I think people are hungry for these things. That's my underlying kind of thing we'll be circling back to. But I want to talk about this experiment. It happened in the summer of 1954, where a social psychologist named Muzaffar Sharif and his colleagues recruited 22 fifth-grade boys from Oklahoma City, and they sent them to two adjacent campsites in a place called Robber's Cave National State Park. You can only imagine trouble is going to happen at a place called Roger's Cave. It's preparing you for that also when you have 22 fifth-grade boys. And the boys were selected to be as close as possible to each other, but they didn't know one another. So they're all white, they're all Protestant, they're all middle class. They're as similar as possible in social, educational, physical, and emotional fitness. And again, none of them had ever met. And as they arrived, they were divided into two groups and sent to two different campsites. And one group was named the Eagles, and the other was called the Rattlers. These were their self-designation. And the first week, they had no knowledge of the other team. They just thought it was them at their campsite doing their thing. They bonded. They did great things. Here are some pictures. You might not be able to read it, but they're climbing on a dam. They're acting out skits. Those are the Rattlers. Maybe they're more theatrical than the Eagles. And here are the Rattlers. They're on a treasure hunt, and here they are preparing a meal. They're just doing things together. But the second week, they were told there's another group of boys at an adjacent campsite. And having never laid eyes on the other group, they immediately started to speak of these people, this other group, as outsiders and intruders, and those boys at the other end of camp. And before long, both sides grew impatient. They wanted to meet, but they wanted to meet in a competitive way. So it was arranged that they met on the baseball diamond. So they came out and they played, and within minutes of seeing each other, one boy called another boy on a different team a dirty shirt. It's like, hey, look at that dirty shirt over there. This is just right away. By the end of the day, they're calling each other names like pigs and bums, which is like a great 1954 put down, which I think we need to bring back. Bums and cheaters. And as you might expect with fifth grade boys, or just humans in general, things got worse. It's hard to tell. This is the Eagles flag. They made a flag. It says, the Eagles, you may win, but we will give you a hell of a fight. And then there's an arrow pointing. That's their motto. And I don't know who Tom Hale is, but he's evidently, maybe he's one of the boys. But the Eagles burned the Rattlers' team flag, and the Rattlers raided the Eagles' cabin in the middle of the night. The Eagles raided the Rattlers' cabin then in the middle of the day. Both teams started to collect rocks, because there's going to be a battle coming down, and you need to be prepared. You got to have rocks. And fistfights started breaking out all the time. Here's another picture. Sorry, it's hard to tell, but This is the stolen flag, and then it's really hard to see here. But the Rattlers have raided the Eagles camp. There's a big stick with a pair of jeans on it. They stole a pair of jeans, and they're waving this pair of jeans like a victory flag. And fist fights were breaking out too much, so end of competitive activities, just arts and crafts. They did do tug of war and stuff like that. But commenting on this project, Liliana Mason, in her book Uncivil Politics, How Politics Became Our Identity, she says, by the end of the second week, 22 highly similar boys who had met only 2 weeks before and had formed two nearly warring tribes, with only the gentle nudge of isolation and competition to encourage them. Now, I think there's more to sort of human nature than just this, but I think it's quite interesting, the gentle nudge of isolation and competition. But we've only talked about the second week. This was a 3-week thing, and as you might expect, it got worse still. So by week 3, the war between the tribes had affected each of the boys' ability to judge reality, like, objectively, or at least attempt objectively. The boys were given the task of collecting as many beans as they could off the ground. I've never been to Oklahoma. I don't know if there's wild beans or if they scattered beans. I don't know all the details there. We can come back in the question and response time. But they were told, the boys were given the task of collecting as many beans as they could. And they gathered both teams together so that each boy's collection could be viewed. They put them on an overhead so you could see how many beans were there. And without fail, every boy estimated that their fellow rattler or their fellow eagle had picked more beans than anyone on the other team. They always thought their team picked more beans. The trick was, though, the same number of beans were shown every single time on the overhead. And not only this, the kids started to conspiracy theorize, if that's a verb, about each other. When one boy stubbed his toe at the swimming hole, he was convinced that the other team had snuck in the middle of the night and put large rocks in the bottom of the swimming hole that he stubbed his toe on. This was a plan for them to get him. Another boy at a different swimming hole said, "It feels colder today in the swimming hole. I think they snuck in the middle of the night and put ice cubes in our swimming hole. They're trying to get us." Now, in a room like this where I don't think there's any fifth grade boys, we might think that we're more tolerant, more mature, more political savvy, more unbiased, and probably less likely to be influenced by the tribes we run in, the groups we run in, especially more so than the Eagles and the Rattlers. And you might be, and if you are, congratulations, but you might not, actually. So I want to take, for example, the research of a guy named Jeffrey Cohen in a paper called Party Over Policy, The Dominant Impact of Group Influence on Political Beliefs. You can, if you Google that, Cohen, Party Over Policy, you can find the PDF. It's readily available. He was a professor of sociology at Yale at the time, and this was published in 2003, so sort of even before what we think of as the heyday of polarized politics in our country. And he gave a group of adults, there were no fifth grade boys in this experiment, he gave them two different welfare policies, two potential welfare policies, one rather stringent and the other very, very generous. And he gave the policy proposals to participants and then randomly assigned these policies with a party. So Republicans like A, Democrats like B, or vice versa. Randomly assigned it, even if the policies themselves didn't align with where the parties traditionally stood. And the participating adults, again, no fifth grade boys were involved in this experiment, almost without fail approved the policy that they were told matched their party as opposed to the one that would match sort of the assumed party's stance on something. So someone who identified as a Democrat, if they were given a policy, a welfare policy that was quite stringent, which would be sort of traditionally more Republican, they still approved of it because they were told this is what your Democratic representatives are putting forward. And just like the boys at Robbers Creek, it actually gets worse. Cohen kept giving them more and more information about the policy to see if it would sway them, if it would change their minds, kind of clue them in, like, this is not what you would accept to have. But it didn't work. And then so Cohen said, how about this? You need to write an op-ed for your local newspaper to try to get this policy approved. And without fail, people wrote kind of heartfelt, rational defenses of these policies that they were told lined up with their party, even if it disagreed with sort of the standard or sort of normative approach that these parties have. So that's where the name of the study comes from, party over policy. And I think this is a great example of what the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt talks about. He says, we often think of our minds as sort of truth-seeking machines, like heat-seeking missiles, looking for the truth. He says, but often our minds are actually more like press secretaries. They come out and they justify some really terrible decision that's been made, and they rapidly make up reasons for it. It doesn't take a lot of imagination or time scrolling through Facebook, your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed, or maybe reading some respectable op-eds from established newspapers to see that this kind of tribal us versus them, party over policy, Rattlers versus Eagle mentality pervades our country. It pervades our families, especially extended families, our workplaces often, our social networks, our churches, and maybe even our homes. And Haidt, Jonathan Haidt, in this book, it's a very interesting book. It's a large book. It's a helpful book. But he says it's not just that we tend towards tribalism. It actually is a little bit worse than that. Our politics tend to have what he calls a Manichaean tendency. Now, if you're like me and you're not at all familiar with 4th century Persian kind of mystic religions, this reference might have flown over your head. Oh, yeah, Manichaean. Manichaeanism is a philosophy that's based off a Persian sage named Mani. This is a picture of him from Wikipedia. And he taught that the visible world was the battleground between the forces of light, which were absolute good, and the forces of darkness, which were absolute evil. And we have all been enlisted on one side or another. We are absolutely good, working for light, or we are absolutely evil, working for darkness. And Haidt comments that when we see politics in a Manichaean way, all compromise is a sin. God and the devil don't issue many bipartisan proclamations, and neither should you. And so it's easy. It's become easier for, if not for us as individuals, at least for talking heads in our culture, to speak of the boys in the other camp, those rattlers, those dirty shirts, those bums, as now kind of saying they've been inscripted by pure evil. They have an agenda. They've been taken on by the forces of darkness. So I want us to think together. I want to present some ideas about how we live well in a moment like this, where we're tribal, we're polarizing, and we're moving tendencies to move towards this kind of Manichaeanism in our politics. And I want to eventually get to asking, do Christians have anything in particular to offer this? And I need to admit up front, Christians have contributed to political polarization. We have thrown fuel on this fire. We have to confess that up front. We have not been a unitive force, I think, in our culture, at least in recent history. That's a more complicated story. We can talk about that as well later. But I want to consider some realities in our culture, some things that are shared across the political spectrum and both ends that I think are true about us, that are contributing to this polarization, but also show that polarization isn't really just about the issues, about disagreeing on particular issues. And so I want to look at four things together to show that polarization is not solely about the issues. First, we're going to talk about pervasive loneliness. From there, the Western life script. From there, blinding political nostalgia. And then finally, a lack of shared experiences. And then at the end, I'm going to just put a few ideas forward on ways we can respond to some of this. And then in our question and answer time, I'd love to have a conversation. I'd love to hear from you, because there's a lot I have to learn about this, and it's important to hear from one another. But I want to start with loneliness, and it's an interesting way to kind of get into polarization. And where I've learned a lot about this from is from Ben Sasse, who's a Republican senator from Nebraska. And this his book in particular, Them. And if you hear Republican senator from Nebraska and you think, I don't want anything to do with this guy, I understand. But this is the first picture of him that shows up if you Google him. This is him talking with Chuck Schumer, and I think that's Tom Cotton. He's just hanging out in a T-shirt and running shorts in Congress. And it's hard to tell because the light, he's got quite a goofy look on his face. He's quite a likable guy, I think. And he's a sharp guy. But he articulates the nature of a loneliness epidemic that we're experiencing in our country. And he talks about how Americans today report having less and less social capital. Social capital is just meant valued human connections, significant communal relationships, that give life, like, meaning. They enrich life in many ways. And so we can think about this as there's a recession of relationships going on. You can think about it, the new normalcy of living alone. In 1940, according to the U.S. Census, only 8% of Americans lived alone. By 2000, that was up to 26% of Americans. The number continues to rise. And in urban places like Boston or Manhattan or San Francisco, it's almost half. Almost half of the population are people living by themselves. And there's more than people just going solo and living on their own. There was a study at Duke University that took place between 1985 and 2004, a long study. And it found that the average American talked about the number of people that the average American talked to about important matters dropped from 3 to 1 over this 20-year period. And by the mid-2000s, 25% of Americans said they had no one to talk to, no other person to talk to, about the things that mattered most. This triples the number from the 1980s. And it's worth noting that those are all sort of before the ubiquitous presence of social media, which I think is often presented as the sort of arch-villain of actual friendships. There was something going on in our culture prior to this. And I think loneliness on this account isn't just not having people around. It includes that, but it's something more. I think it's connected to a difficulty in finding meaning to one's life, being able to sort of keep the plot. Humans are meaning-making creatures, and we often find that through relationships with other people. So apart from a solid network of at least a few relationships, people begin to lose the plot. What is the point of all of this? And it's not only that loneliness hinders finding meaning. We're learning that loneliness is actually bad for our health, both our political health, but our individual health. There's a growing body of literature, loneliness literature, that's come out over the last 20 years that's looking at this. And I think in some ways it's filling out sort of the proclamation we hear in Genesis 1 that it's not good for humans to be alone. This sort of shows some of the ways that it's not good. So according to some researchers at Ohio State, which if you can trust anything from Ohio State, sorry, he went to Ohio State. You can, it's a good place, sorry. This needs some levity. It gets pretty sad here, actually. But according to researchers at Ohio State and the University of Chicago, the emotional stress of loneliness can cause us to age faster, makes us more prone to cognitively degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And not only that, if you combined all of the stress of loneliness, they conclude that one day of loneliness extracts the same toll on the body as smoking an entire pack of cigarettes. There is an interdisciplinary workshop that happens annually at the University of Berlin, and one of them was on attachment and bonding, and they found that positive social relationships are second only to genetics in predicting the health and longevity in humans. A researcher at the University of California, Irvine, found that persistent loneliness reduces the average life almost twice as much as heavy drinking and almost 3 times as much as obesity. The former U.S. Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, recently spoke to the Boston Globe. I don't know if anyone saw that. And he said, the data is unambiguous. Loneliness is killing us. And there's also been a significant increase in what have been dubbed deaths of despair, which are drug overdoses, alcoholism, suicide. Very complex components feed into those things. But loneliness has to be one of the contributing factors, I think, if we're going to take an honest look at this. And I want to look briefly at drug overdoses. So in 2016, in America, 63,632 people died of drug overdoses, which was 11,000 more than 2015. And it's also more than the number of American soldiers that died in the 27 years of the Vietnam War. It's twice as many people who died in car crashes, which for decades has been the leading cause of death in America. And so our ever-increasingly lonely American population, struggling to find relationships and meaning in their life, are consuming more and more drugs, in particular Oxycontin and hydrocodone. And the journalist Andrew Sullivan talks about these two drugs in particular. And he says these drugs aren't used to just merely dull physical pain. They're meant to dull existential pain. So Sullivan says the oxytocin, which is a naturally occurring chemical and a pleasure chemical in our brain. He says we experience this from love, from friendship, from orgasm. What we experience naturally is chemically replaced by the molecules derived from the poppy plant. It's a shortcut and an instant intensification of the happiness we might ordinarily experience in a good communal life. Sullivan goes on to talk about an experiment with rats and how different rats responded to water with morphine in it, which is like rat heroin, basically. And he found that a rat alone in a cage drinks five times the amount of water that has this opioid in it, this morphine in it, as a rat whose cage had food, toys to play with, a spinning wheel, and the presence of other rats. He says in summary, take away the stimulus of community and all the oxytocin it naturally generates, and an artificial variety of the substance becomes much more compelling. And just to give another statistic, on the average day in 2016, 116 people in the U.S. died from an opioid-related overdose, which is five times higher than 1999. Five times higher. And there are many factors there, and I don't want to simplify it or make it fit perfectly in the story I'm trying to tell, but loneliness is part of the equation, is part of what's feeding into that. Our loneliness is literally killing us. It's a bipartisan phenomenon. People on the left and the right are hungry for real relationships and struggling to find meaning and purpose for their lives. Arthur Brooks, who's the president of the American Enterprise Institute, sums this up and says that the existential pain of loneliness can find quick and easy relief in many places. And he says, people who have a hole in their heart often fill it with angry politics. Right? Angry politics gives you community, gives you a tribe to run in, gives you a purpose, gives you a common enemy. I think he's onto something. When people have a hole in their heart, they fill it with angry politics. So I want to take a step back now, though, from moving from pervasive loneliness. I want to step away from the more concrete reality of loneliness to something that's a little more abstract and theoretical. A particular way of understanding what it means to be human, an anthropology, what I'm going to call the Western life script. And I'm drawing here a lot from the work of a political philosopher named Patrick Deneen in his book, Why Liberalism Failed. Deneen teaches at Notre Dame. And when he talks about liberalism, he's not talking about left-leaning progressive politics, those liberals, liberal as opposed to conservative, Democrat as opposed to Republican. He's talking about a particular way of understanding being human, an anthropology. And he says that both sides, both the left and the right, presuppose this. He calls this liberalism. And he sees this anthropology as something like the operating system on your computer. It's functioning, it's there, and you don't notice it's there until it crashes. And he says it's crashed and it's failed, and we need to start paying attention to it. So he defines it like this. This is actually how the book opens. A political philosophy conceived some 500 years ago and put into effect at the birth of the United States nearly 250 years later was a wager that political society could be grounded on a different footing. It conceived of humans as right-bearing individuals who could fashion for themselves their own version of the good life. So for him, the work of liberal politics is to secure liberty, where liberal, liberty comes from, so the individual can fashion for themselves the type of life they want, the type of good life. And this might not sound particularly unique to us, because this is the air we breathe. We're pretty downstream from all of this. But this is in contrast to most non-Western and pre-Enlightenment cultures, which understood people as primarily social creatures. We find our meaning together. We don't just make up the story of our life or the world however we want it. We receive our identity. We receive a vision of the good. Deneen. I always struggle with his name. Anyway, I wish he could have a name like Sass. That's just a simple name. Sass. But he, actually, Deneen isn't a hard name either, but anyway. He contrasts liberalism with these classical cultures, and he includes the Christian faith in this. Because he says they all, to some degree or another, have a more honest, though tragic, take on being human. What we would call the fallen state of humanity. Admitting that something is not right with us. We have this internal bent, both towards self-deception, towards violence, to the misuse of power, and we actually need something out from outside of ourselves to flourish so we can realize what we can be. The path to liberty in these cultures is realized through the long but good work of submitting ourselves to a tradition of virtue, as well as accepting self-restraint. Only a virtuous people can be free, and we have to learn what it means to be free. But this is the opposite of the Western life script. Think of the famous words of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, "Man is born free, but everywhere is in chains." And these aren't necessarily literal chains. These are cultural chains. These are familial chains, religious chains, traditional chains that we need to free ourselves from. And so on Deneen's read, whether you have a vision of a small, limited government, which needs to leave me alone so I can live my life the way I want to live it, or if you have a vision of large government that needs to create social networks and systems which will enable people to lead the life they want to lead as they choose, they both work with the same view of being human. Mm-hmm. So Ben last night pointed out a great resource, a podcast called This Cultural Moment, which is a pastor from Portland, Oregon, and a pastor from somewhere in Australia, Melbourne, Australia. And one of the guys, this guy from Australia, Mark Sayers, gives a thought experiment that I think kind of conveys this well. You would do well to listen to this. Go back and listen to the old ones. The episode that this comes from is titled "Millennials at Fox News, Satanists, and the Fallout of Deconstructionism." Very appealing. And they're not saying millennials at Fox News are Satanists. They are different categories. I mean, there might be, anyway. But he presents this thought experiment in it that I think gets at the heart of what Deneen is talking about. He says, if you took a group of interns at Fox News and you took a group of interns at MSNBC, two opposing antithetical takes on American life today and what the problems are. He said, and if you sit them down and you talked with them about all the sort of the scripted talking points, you talk about abortion, you talk about immigration, you talk about the wall, you talk about gun control, you're going to get completely different answers. They're polarized. They're totally different. He said, but if you followed them home and you watched their lives, you watched their relationship to time, their relationship with money, their connection to a particular place, their connection to the earth, their connection to relationships that aren't relationships they chose, you would see these people live fairly similar lives. Fairly similar lives. And this is what Sayers calls the Western life script of individualism. He says it's just papered over by this polarizing ideology. And this way of living and thinking, Deneen's arch villain, liberalism, has succeeded. It is the pervasive way that people understand themselves today. It's the air I breathe too. I'm working against this myself. But the title of his book is Why Liberalism Failed. And his argument is it failed actually because it succeeded. He says that this view of being human it is unsustainable because at its root, all of our collective crisis today, he says, the root of this is this view of the free-floating, autonomous individual. It's not just political polarization. It's our failing educational system, our struggling economic system, the environmental crisis, the massive social fragmentation that we see. The list goes on and on and on. If there's anything wrong in the world, he sort of says it's liberalism's fault. It's this view of the isolated individual, the autonomous individual. And this word he uses time and time again to sort of describe it is he says, on this view of being human, all relationships are fungible. Everybody heard that word? I'd never heard, or fungible? I think it, what is it? Is it fungible? I think it's fungible. I don't know. But either way, I'd never heard this word before. What does it mean? It means every relationship besides your relationship with yourself, your relationship with your family, your relationship to the earth, your relationship to your church, your relationship to your tradition, all of these things are replaceable. They're not essential to who you are. They don't make you you. You decide what's you. You're not connected to anything. And he says this view of being human is at the root of all of our crises.
So he saying fun or fungus or what is he saying?
Fungible. No, it's just a word. It's a word.
An economics term.
Yeah, I'd never heard the word before I read this book. No, he doesn't think it's fun. He thinks it's... Well, actually, it's fun. It's just he actually talks about this as a 250-year party we've been living that we're just waking up from.
Wow.
We're just sobering up from and realizing there's been all this unexpected fallout. But I think part of what he's after here is this view of the individual. We are alone in the cosmos, right? We're floating along figuring out what we need. This is our natural state. Our natural state is not one of being in community, of being in a tradition, but of making a story for ourselves. And to sort of riff on Arthur Brooks' line, that people who have a hole in their heart fill it with angry politics. I think people who feel as though they're just floating through the cosmos can be tethered, be brought down to some place by angry politics. So this Western life script feeds into this. Hard transition. The next thing I want to talk about is blinding political nostalgia, because nostalgic people are actually looking for a better time. So super insightful on this, and I think maybe one of the best books I read on this whole thing is by a guy named Yuval Levin. The book is called The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. And it's more of a historical analysis of the last 70 years of American public and political life. And he highlights that Americans are not just polarizing politically and fragmenting socially, but these lonely, individualistic, sort of free-floating people are profoundly nostalgic. And he says nostalgia blinds us to the nature of our present moment. Nostalgia being a sentimental longing or an affection for a previous time, for the good old days. This is a pervasive theme in much of our political rhetoric, as well as, I think, in people's frustration, people's anxiety, how they view what's going on. So I want to quote, give a little bit of a longer quote from a major American politician that I think evidences this, that shows this. I'm going to ask if anybody can guess who it is. And if you saw the picture before when I was doing the slides for Andrew, you can't guess. You're disqualified. But the person says this: many people, can probably remember a time when finding a job meant showing up at a nearby factory or a business downtown. You didn't need a degree, and your competition was pretty much limited to your neighbors. If you worked hard, chances are you'd have a job for life, with a decent paycheck and good benefits, and the occasional promotion. Maybe you'd even have the pride of seeing your kids work at the same company. The world has changed, and for many of us, the change has been painful. So any guesses who this might be? Anyone?
Barack Obama.
Did you know that?
I read the book.
You read the book? Oh, you're disqualified too. Yeah. All right, you get the prize. This could be what Elizabeth Warren said 2 weeks ago in Lawrence when she launched her presidential campaign officially. This could be what Marco Rubio said. This could be what Mitt Romney said. If it had a few more kind of errors and was a little more angry, it could be what our president said. That's my only jab for the whole thing. But this sort of nostalgia, and here's a picture. Sorry, it's actually hard to see it in light. But this sort of nostalgia is powerful, and it appeals on emotional level, especially for people who feel overlooked, for people who feel alone, and for people who are struggling to find meaning. But Levin sees this desire for some golden era of American life as blinding. The false nostalgia blinds us to the nature of our present moment, because it seems to presuppose that our present moment of uncertainty, disunity, isolation, of anger and polarization, this isn't the norm for America. That's what this presupposes. But there's been some sort of aberration. There's been a deviation, what would have otherwise been our naturally occurring path, and someone has taken us off course. Probably those dirty shirt rattlers. I mean, there's no doubt, though, that there have been less polarized days for America, times when people reported more social capital, when they weren't as alone. But depending on America was never great in that, and it was never perfect in that sense. It all depends on who you ask. Those days especially were difficult days for minority people in our country. And so Levin's argument is for very, very real, there's very real differences between the parties, but it's not just Trumpers that want to make America great again. We all want to make America great again. And he highlights that there's three problems with this sort of political nostalgia. The first is that we're all disagreed on when America was great. Right? We disagree about which days we should be nostalgic for. So Levin writes, "Democrats talk about public policy as though it were always 1965, and the model of the Great Society welfare state will answer our every concern." And then he says, "And Republicans talk as though it were always 1981, and the repetition of the Reagan Revolution is the cure for what ails us." He ends by saying, "It's hardly surprising that the public finds the resulting political debates frustrating." Right? Both of these different political strategies, and I'm not arguing for one or the other, but just pointing out they have a nostalgic ring to them. And they're longing for better days, both sides. Everybody wants to make America great again. We just disagree on when. But it's also, and this is in large ways the burden of his book, what he's doing in this book, is he's trying to show those days are not only long gone, but those great days that we can't agree about, as well as the economic and cultural factors which made them great, those were all historically contingent. And so by nature, it's quite difficult, if not impossible, to just de facto recreate those days by repeating the same policies without being aware of how things have changed in our culture. So those great days, we disagree with when they were, but those days themselves were contingent, and we can't just recreate them again. This is a large part of the historical work that he does in the book. I found it a super fascinating book, really insightful book. And then the third thing is that nostalgic politics' sentimental spin on this previous age, maybe of innocence, of unity. They inadvertently blame the other side, right? Someone has taken us off course for the decline that has taken place. And so it easily leads to a politics of resentment because they're the ones who put rocks in our swimming hole. They've ruined our swimming hole. It's not great. Let's make the swimming hole great again. And it's not a long stretch to go from these kind of politics of resentment to that Manichaean kind of pure evil, pure good politics that Haidt was talking about. And then, so again, to riff on Arthur Brooks' insight, that people who have a hole in their heart often fill it with angry politics. I think people that are blinded by nostalgia often think angry politics will help them see more clearly, but it doesn't. It's part of the appeal. So the final thing I want to talk about that we share, that is sort of underneath and feeding all this, is that we don't actually share experiences anymore. There's a decline in shared experience in American culture. There's a lot to say about this, and I'm gonna, actually following Ben Sass's lead, talk about, the sort of things we watch on TV. The final episode of MASH, this is sort of the final scene as he flies off in the helicopter. Feel free to tear up if you need to. It's a very significant moment in American television. I was a year old when this aired. But when it aired in 1983, nearly 123 million Americans tuned in, which was about 54% of the country. And in New York City, within seconds of the finale, the end of this episode, so many people flushed their toilet at the exact same time that it set a record for the pressure of for water use and pressure in the city's sewer system. It caused all sorts of problems. Because all of these people were holding it, watching the end of MASH. And it sounds kind of silly, but it was very much a shared experience. And the sewer system attests to that. I got more laughs than I thought it would. But if you move back further to 1951 and the show I Love Lucy, when it debuted, even more people watched that. Two-thirds of Americans tuned in to watch it. That was the peak of sort of shared entertainment, TV entertainment. And to put it in perspective, how things have changed. So over two-thirds of people watched I Love Lucy. The most watched, regularly occurring show program in America right now is Sunday Night Football. And it peaked in 2014 when 14% of the American population watched it, tuned into it. It's dropped since then. So we've gone from two-thirds to 14%. And huge shows like Game of Thrones, on their best nights, like a season finale, pull in 4% of the American population. The biggest names on cable news, Arthur Brooks, the guy who I've quoted about people have a hole in their heart, he calls these sorts of things the outrage industrial complex. But all the cable news pundits like Sean Hannity or Rachel Maddow get about 1% of the American population. So our landscape is radically different, our entertainment landscape, our cultural landscape is different. There's unimaginably more options now than 1951 when there were four channels. 93% of Americans have access to over 500 channels, as well as the endless scroll of the internet. Live streams, web shows, podcasts, social media. And it's on those sort of diffuse and unaccountable platforms that more and more lonely people are taking in their news and taking in their entertainment. And as these platforms that have smaller people are watching them, they actually keep tabs on us, on what we view, on what we buy, on the stories we like, on the stories we share with our friends. And so they know when we like those things, we want more of those things. So they give us those things. They do that because it helps them make money. All of these kind of things online are free more times than not. They offer us a way to kind of medicate our pain, distract us from our loneliness, or confirm our biases. They never challenge our take or our tribe's take on the world. The Atlantic's Julie Beck says that we are effectively building pillow forts of comfortable and confirming information around us, and is making all the more difficult for anything we don't want to hear to get through. So just like the Rattlers and the Eagles, who lost their ability to objectively kind of judge the amount of beans on a screen, or the study, the party over policy study done by the Yale University professor, we like what best suits our own story. We like what congratulates our own tribe and confirms our own biases. And in an age of literally endless options for news and entertainment, it doesn't take us long for us to find one that will pat us on the back. So Ben Sasse writes about this. It isn't just that living in ideological bubbles makes it hard to criticize one's own side. It's also that it actually becomes harder to believe credible charges against one's own tribe. I think we've seen this happen quite a bit. But we're talking about hope this weekend, right? Hope in a fragmented world. That was in the title. And so I want to point to one place that we still share, but I think is a place for some hope in all of this. And it's that most people are exhausted by political polarization. They're tired of it. There is a study done. It's called the More in Common Study. You can Google it. It's connected to Yale. It was a large-scale survey that kind of confirms the hunch, I think, that I have, that polarization really isn't just about policies and issues. It's about belonging to tribes in some way. But it found that the majority of Americans, 77% of Americans, actually don't think we've gone too far. Think it's not inevitable for us to find ways to come together, to keep working. But they're exhausted. So this chart is actually much harder probably for you to see than I intended. But they sort of divided the country up, these people that they studied. And so it runs across from progressive activists, traditional liberals, mainline liberals, politically disengaged, moderates, traditional conservatives, and devoted conservatism. And it found that the majority of Americans fall somewhere in the middle here, and they call them the exhausted majority, because they're tired. They're tired of hearing these things. And it seems like it often feels as though the whole world is viewing the world through their angry Twitter stream or sort of this outrage industrial complex news programs, and that people are angry. But I think people are really exhausted, and they fall into this middle place. And the professor of literature at Baylor, Alan Jacobs, in his really fun, interesting book called How to Think, A Survival Guide for a World at Odds, it's a book about not just thinking, but what's that? It's about sort of living well in a world at odds. It's not just about thinking. He says that he works with this idea of the repugnant cultural other. And he says we miss the truth that so many people are actually more in the middle when we view the world through this lens of the repugnant cultural other that we can pick up through our Twitter feeds, through the news we watch. But he says this, that this view of the rest of our culture, it prevents us from recognizing others as our neighbors, even when they are quite literally our neighbors. If I'm consumed by this belief that the person over there is both other and repugnant, I may never discover that my favorite television program is also their favorite television program. That we may like the same sort of books, though not for precisely the same reasons. That we know what it's like to nurse a loved one through a long illness. All of which is to say that I may too easily forget that the political and social and religious differences are not the whole of the human experience. The cold, divisive logic of the repugnant cultural other impoverishes us, all of us. And it seems that people are just tired of they're exhausted by some of this thinking. Our friends and our neighbors want to be friends and want to have neighbors. So with this in place, kind of talking through all of these things, I have a few ideas, a few ways forward that we'll walk through quickly. Then we'll take the break and we'll come back and talk. But the first thing is I think we need to let people know that they belong here, especially as Christians. The Bible starts with this picture of God creating a world that he calls good, that is his sacred place. And he puts people in there, not isolated individuals, but people together. The Christian view of human is that we're social. We belong together. And that we belong here. We have dignity. We have worth. We have value. And so I think we need to extend that to our neighbors and friends, saying, you belong here in my home. You belong here around my table. This is part of what we attempt to do, imperfectly, but we attempt to do at LaBrie, to welcome people in, to say, you belong here. I think people are very hungry for places to belong. And the second thing I think we need to learn, I learned from sitting around someone else's table, my father-in-law's table, who, if he's listening to this, hi, Mike. But it's the importance of asking the question, what am I not seeing? It's not long after the election, we were having dinner and we realized we voted very differently and we think about these things differently. And we had a very strong conversation, not an overly heated conversation. I know that's a rare thing in and of itself. And we kept talking around these things. We're very different people. We live here in Massachusetts. We work for a religious nonprofit in a very progressive state. They live in sort of in central California, the foothills of the Yosemite, or of the right by Yosemite Park, but in the right by the Sierra Nevadas, or just the Sierras. But he is a small business owner, and in a place in a state that has made having a small business difficult, to say the least. But we kept talking around and around, and finally he looked and he asked us. He said it with all sincerity and with all honesty, what am I not seeing? Can you tell me what I'm not seeing? And this was such an instructive moment for me. I've had a lot of instructive moments with him. He's a solid guy. But asking this question, what am I not seeing? And a similar point is made in a book called The Three Languages of Politics by a guy named Arnold King. And he says there's three major political biases or filters that Americans use to make sense of the political landscape. And these are admittedly simplistic. He says progressives tend to view the world as a battle between victims and oppressors. Conservatives tend to see the world as a battle between civilization and chaos or barbarism. And libertarians, and he's a libertarian, I'm not a libertarian, but I'm learning from libertarians. Libertarians see the world as a battle between freedom and coercion. And he makes the point that each sees something that's important, something that's real, that many of us can be blind to. So we need to ask the question, what am I not seeing? Progressives, in a desire to empathize with victims, can sometimes misconstrue victims as just victims and downplay their agency. Conservatives, in a good desire to conserve good things, can demonize those that they perceive to be threats. Libertarians can romanticize the power of economic or social liberty, but can ignore the good and important work of government or other social institutions. We all need to ask each other, what am I not seeing? This doesn't mean we're going to agree. But this sort of question, I think, builds in us empathy to see that other people see the world differently or are standing in very different places. There's more to say about this. And again, this isn't a surefire strategy to make sure we all end up in the same place, but at least that we can sit around a table and have a humanizing question where we live with our differences. The next thing I want to point out, this is a little more Christian, is the call of Jesus has to relativize the call of our political tribes, in some sense. So there's lots of ways we could parse this out. There's just two places in the New Testament I want to look at that I think are somewhat instructive to us. So the first is in Matthew's Gospel, where he talks about, he's just listing off the disciples. And so this is the first four verses of Matthew 10. He said, "And he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction." The names of the 12 apostles are these: first, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Now, it's interesting that Matthew, who's a tax collector, and Judas, who's a zealot, the people who get a little more behind their name are usually someone's brother or Judas, but they're associated with their sort of political tribe. A tax collector is a Jew who's compromised with the Roman Empire. They've made the land ritually impure, so it's not just sort of a political setup. There's a religious impurity that comes with being a tax collector. You're unclean. But he's compromised, and it's done him something better. It's lined his pockets. He's doing well. And his vision of being Israel, being the people of God, is, look, we just got to work with the powers that be in this way. And then on the other end of the spectrum is Simon, who's a zealot. Zealots were, this is a significantly broader divide than left versus right or MSNBC versus Fox News. Like this is sort of like Fox News versus like a radical militia member, like in South America or somewhere. Like this is not even part of our landscape. But both of these men were their political tribes, being a zealot, being a tax collector, these ways of understanding being Israel, being God's people, they were trumped by the call to follow Jesus. It doesn't say that they left. Well, anyway, we'll stop. I got to keep moving. The other thing that I think is helpful that helps us see this is Paul's image in Philippians. He says twice in Philippians that we're citizens of heaven. He says here, Philippians 3:20, but your citizenship is in heaven, and from it we await a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. And I have heard this and thought, I've read this and thought for a long time, this means I'm not really a citizen of earth, so it doesn't matter. I don't really need to be involved here because my citizenship is somewhere else. But I think this is perhaps missing what Paul's intention is here. So Philippi was a city that existed outside of the borders of Rome, but they were granted the status of a colony, which means even though you're not within the empire of Rome, you get the status of being Rome. You don't pay taxes. You get the privileges of being Rome. You get protection. I mean, being in the Roman Empire was still a brutal place, but it was significantly more brutal outside. So a colony exists outside. You get citizenship, you get protection, you get all of these benefits. But it's a deal. It works. If you get citizenship, your job is to spread the culture of Rome in the place where you live. So the aesthetics of Rome, the politics of Rome, the culture of Rome, that was the job of a Philippian citizen. They get the benefits, but they spread the culture. And what Paul is talking about here, I think, is not that we don't care about what's going on, but that our political tribes and their package deals, right, don't always resemble the politics of heaven, if we want to say like that. But our job, as people who've been made citizens of heaven, is to bring that culture here, to bring justice, to bring truth, forgiveness, mercy, humility. I could keep going. But I think these both show that there's a call. The call of Jesus relativizes and trumps the call of our own political tribes. And the final thing I want to say is we live in an angry moment, a polarized moment, where those dirty shirt rattlers are throwing ice in our swimming hole. And people are really, really angry. And I am someone who struggles with anger myself. And so does my son. And so we talk a fair bit about anger. And a realization that I've learned throughout my life is that anger is not always a primary emotion. There's lots of good and legitimate reasons to be angry. And being angry isn't necessarily a sin. It's not a bad thing, necessarily. But it's not a primary emotion often. For me, I'm angry because I'm hurt. because I'm overlooked by something, because I feel like I don't belong anywhere, because better things are happening to other people when they should be happening to me. And so we talk about in our home that anger is a good indicator that something is wrong, but it is often a terrible interpreter, right? I tell my son, it's like a flashing red light. There's trouble ahead. Something's not right. But it's also like a dirty pair of glasses that you can't actually see through. So I think when we see an angry population, people that are frustrated and anger, they're often hurting people. They need to know there's a place where they belong. There's a hole in people's hearts, and they're filling it with angry politics. People feel as though they're wandering aimlessly in the cosmos, and they're filling it with angry politics. People have been blinded by nostalgia of a better day, and so they feel that they can retrieve those better days kind of through angry politics. And so we need to let people know that they can belong, right? And that their problems are real, and they belong in our homes and around our tables. But that anger isn't maybe the only thing that's going on. There's something else underneath. And so that's where I want to stop. And